Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. And of course, we should say a happy 2023. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy. It's been ages since we spoke.
It's been so long since we spoke and since we shared the same audio space. We're very, very happy to have you back. I'm sure that listeners were thinking, what's going on? Where is she?
They thought we'd had a terrible row, you and me, and I'd stopped off. That's what
one of us said, something unforgivable.
Yes, exactly. We had a tremendous argument over a bit of metaphysical poetry and I stopped off. No, I was on the high seas.
Wonderful.
I was on the Queen Mary too.
So grand.
Very grand. Very, very grand. It was just me. There was nobody else on it. I got the whole boat just to myself. And then I got back. And of course, you know, as many of our listeners, I'm sure, I got the bug and the bug rather laid me low for a while. And so, yes, it's been ages. But here I am in fine fettle and raring to go.
Well, we're very, very glad.
How are you, Lucy? How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Fine. Our listeners will know that because you were away, Alex, I dragged Charlotte, our producer, out from behind the fourth wall.
That's all I need, another piranha in the tank.
Got her to tell us some wonderful stories.
I bet she
stories.
Was absolutely brilliant.
She was brilliant. Yeah, yes,
and
I'm
clinging on. I know, I'm clinging on. Well, I'm delighted that you weren't just, you know, having to do the whole thing on your own. I'm delighted to be back. Now tell us, what is going on in the paper this week? I know there's something very interesting.
Well, the lead is interesting. It's an extract, an edited extract, actually, just for the paper this week, of a book which is actually published by TLS Books. You can hear me. Would you like some atmospheric audio? This is me rustling the TLS.
Yes. Yeah.
There you go.
Very good.
The book's called Lawfare: How Russians, the Rich and the Government Try to Prevent Free Speech and How to Stop Them. And it's by Jeffrey Robertson, KC, not QC, KC now. And the stand first of the piece is that Russian oligarchs are using British courts to close down investigative journalism. So he's done a whole book about that, which is out in, I think, 2 days. And this is an edited extract of it. So that's a bit of a must read, that one. There's also a brilliant piece about Arthur Miller and his life, his writing life, and it's part of a Jewish Live series, actually, and his life with Marilyn Monroe, and lots of other fascinating things that we are going to talk about in a bit, aren't we?
We are. We certainly are.
You wanted to highlight a couple of kind of remembrances, I think.
I did, because, you know, we're always obviously sad when we lose writers, and two writers with extraordinary careers have died in recent times. One, of course, is Faye Weldon, who was just such a sort of memorable and vivid presence in the literary scene in general and in women's writing. And it was very noticeable how many writers wanted to share their memories of her when she died, and nearly all of them talking about how encouraging she was and what a sort of warm and open space she made for writers starting out on their careers and for other writers when they were getting further along in their careers. And it was very touching, I thought.
She was a great sort of champion.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other writer, at the age of 100, Ronald Blythe, the author of Aikenfield, and one time great pal of Patricia Highsmith, also died. And it was really, again, interesting to read remembrances of him and this incredibly sort of multifaceted life that he had. He did so many different things aside from writing, you know. Those one thing that I read that he'd had a, until, you know, not that many years ago, had a weekly diary in the Church Times, which wasn't something that I would particularly have expected to read.
He had a book came out last year, I mean not long ago, I mean I think 2 or 3 months ago, of his. And in fact I read it's a kind of yearly diary. I'm not sure if it's from the Church Times or not. I read the January entry the other day, and it was wonderful. It's such a close observation, but it's sort of very welcoming. It kind of draws you in. He describes beautifully what the winter's like and then goes, oh, it's great to be inside. You know, it doesn't make you feel bad for not tramping around the hedgerows. He's very big on his cats, and he's very big on the life of the church as well. But none of it shuts you out. It all brings you in. And it's that amazing thing of being very, very local, hyper local, very, very detailed. But you feel that it could apply to anyone. It was wonderful, actually.
I must look that out, because, you know, cats and the great indoors are two of my great passions in life. Now, observation actually is a real key to some of the things that we're talking about this week. Coming up on this week's show, Gabriel Roberts takes us back to a time when aurochs roamed the earth and oysters massed in Chesapeake Bay, and ponders whether we could ever regain such levels of bioabundance. And novelist Gwendolyn Riley joins us to discuss the new book, in fact, the first novel for 21 years, from Michael Bracewell.
But first, we're going to talk about biodiversity and, yes, inevitably, the loss of it. But we're also going to look at the idea of bioabundance, what it was and why we might need to turn to literature and such writers as Defoe, Keats and even Shakespeare to get an idea of it. Gabriel Roberts, who's an English teacher and also involved in environmental education with a background in English and intellectual history, has written a fascinating piece on the subject this week for us, and he joins us today to talk through it. Gabriel, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you start your piece by telling us about your own fascination with birds and how that evolved and how your attitude towards sort of rare and common birds changed. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, I think my earliest memory actually is of a sparrow that was semi-tame and used to come into our kitchen when I was a kid. And I think from that early moment of sort of feeding this bird, I was fascinated with birds. And so when I was growing up, when other kids were probably off playing football and doing things like that, I was reading bird books and I had lots of them and I cross-referenced them with each other. And I would then go outdoors on holiday or around the town I grew up in and I'd look for birds. And this was all well and good. But as I grew up and I became more aware of what I was watching, I came to realise that actually some of the species I was observing were declining in numbers. So when I was young, there were sparrows in my back garden. And then when I was a teenager, there weren't. Or to give another example, I was aware of the number of swifts declining in my local area, again, across the same kind of time span. And then gradually I became more and more aware of how these trends that I was spotting on a local scale actually fitted into longer trends that biologists and ecologists had measured over the past sort of 30, 40, 50 years. And then as I became more interested in history, I came to realize that actually some of these trends stretched right back hundreds, thousands of years into the past. And it dawned on me that a long time ago, many parts of the natural world were considerably more abundant than they are today.
I was so interested in something you pointed out that makes perfect sense once it's being pointed out to you, but you don't necessarily think of that. When you become a sort of enthusiast and a sort of spotter in this case, or a collector or something, you are drawn towards rarity, aren't you? You think the important thing is spotting the rare animal or the rare stamp or coin or whatever it is that's your thing. And it kind of might briefly sort of blind you to what's happening with these larger species, things that are more common. So if, in other words, if they're declining, you may be slightly blinded from seeing that because you're always after this sort of rare thing. It was just a terribly interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, and it leads, I think, to a sort of very complex emotion. The person who goes out to see the rare thing, when they find it, might experience a thrill or a sense of achievement in that. You say to yourself, I have tracked down this bustard or whatever it is. You know, very hard thing to find, but I found it. I must have exercised some skill in doing that. But then that sense of triumph is mingled with a sense of sadness or confusion when you think, hold on, why is this thing so rare? Wouldn't it be nice if there were more of these things? And then when you realize that it's rare because, you know, the habitat that it lives on has been depleted or it's been persecuted by humans or whatever the reason is, that then contributes to an even greater sense of perplexity, really.
It reminded me of, like you said, Alex, like a collector. It's like being a collector. You want the rarities, except they're not stamps. They're living creatures. And I loved what you said about that your attitude shift. And then actually you started taking delight in the much more common things like starlings or sparrows, but also tracking how the birds, which used to be much more common, they too are decreasing in number pretty rapidly.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. These days I find that I take pleasure in wildlife in a very different way to how I did when I was younger. When I was a child, I wanted to track down the rarities, whereas these days I pretty much take pleasure in anything, whether it's sort of, you know, pigeons flying around in an urban setting or relatively common birds like sparrows. I still take a great delight in that, which I think I wouldn't have done when I was younger. I think I would have been much more dismissive. And yet, as you say, some things that until quite recently were really pretty common and abundant are now doing quite badly. So swifts, which I mentioned earlier, are a really good example of that. For lots of people, they think of them as a very common bird, but actually the overall population trend is very much downwards. And there are all kinds of efforts to try and provide nest sites for them and arrest that decline.
Sometimes we don't realise, I mean, the numbers are sometimes just so astonishing to someone like me, who is not in any sense an expert or even knowledgeable at all. I mean, you talk about right whales and how they were once terribly common. And this is sort of the other part of the piece is how these things have sort of been tracked throughout history and all the kind of different aspects of that. But terribly, terribly common in, as you point out, in Cape Cod, for example, in the 1600s. And now the population of right whales is less than 400. And you suddenly think, less than 400 sounds vanishingly few to me.
Well, yeah, they're pretty much on the brink of extinction. I mean, there are enormous efforts to try and protect them and make sure they're not hit by ships and adversely affected by humans and otherwise. But you find similar things across lots of other species of animal. Tigers, for example, used to range across the whole of Asia, pretty much, right even into Europe. So like when Hamlet, for example, refers to the Hyrcanian beast in play Hamlet, he's referring to tigers and he's referring to a place called Hyrcania, which was on the shore of the Caspian Sea. But the Caspian Sea is now miles away from any wild tiger population. And so there you have sort of extent being limited as well as absolute numbers. Just linking back as well, the right whale example is really interesting because, of course, they're enormous animals. And so if you had a great abundance of right whales, you would also have to have an enormous abundance of all the things that they live on. So that would suggest you not only had abundance at the top end of the food chain, but you also had abundance at various levels going down the food chain, right down to plankton and things at the bottom.
In the beginning of the piece, you go back to some of our earliest accounts of life, cave paintings and things, which speak of massive abundance of all animals across the globe, don't you? And just the fact that everything just seems to be kind of teeming and bursting with life. And then moving up into times that we may recognise a bit more, this is where you're saying that we turn to literature. We turn to what we think of as literary writers for our evidence, which is completely sort of fascinating. And I hadn't thought about that before. So why are we turning to Defoe and Shakespeare and these people? Why do we need to turn to them for our evidence?
This is a really complex issue. There's quite a lot to say about it. It is worth saying that there are people who have come at this issue of declining wildlife populations from a different angle, from the perspective of biology and zoology and ecology and those kinds of subjects. And there are increasingly studies of what some people call defaunation, that is the removal of fauna from the world. And there are studies of biomass and its changing distribution and scale over time. And they draw on a variety of kinds of evidence. And they try to construct more systematic studies of this than the one I put together. What I'm doing is approaching the same topic from another direction. I'm deliberately using an assortment of historical and literary and artistic examples, which are not meant to be systematic. What they're meant to do instead is to be evocative and to make people think of examples from their own experiences and from their own reading. And if you like, contribute those examples to the pool of information on this. And also I want people to think seriously about how they feel about this. And just being represented with data of, say, distribution of biomass over the last sort of 100,000 years isn't necessarily going to engage people's emotions and their imaginations. Whereas I think using some of the examples that I use, although they are rather sort of happenstance-ish in their character, does have the capacity to engage people's emotions and imaginations. Another reason, though, for going to some of the kind of sources that I go to is that actually there is not a lot of evidence in this area. If you read the scientific papers on defaunation or on biomass distribution, one of the things they stress again and again is that actually there isn't a huge amount to go on. Systematic surveying of wildlife populations in many cases only began in the 1970s. And although there are some sort of data sets that run back a bit earlier than that, shooting records, some fishing records, records of pelts taken by the Hudson Bay Company, they all go back sort of into the 19th century. And also, you might notice in the piece I talk about a vermin control records from early modern England, which provides some quite useful long-term data from early periods. But those kinds of sources are the exception. On the whole, you don't have very much to go on. And so you have to sort of gather together what's available and make your best estimates on the basis of that.
You're sort of brought face to face with all the different things that are going on when sort of books are being written and made and compiled. And so obviously when you've got, you know, Defoe saying, you know, he'd seen a million swallows, we know it's not literally a million. But when you also mention medieval bestiaries. And you think, well, you argue that they actually did indicate, you know, people recorded things that they had seen. They give a sort of idea of what might have been abundant, what might have been in the normal view. But obviously they're also kind of quite sort of myth-making volumes in some ways. And it's so hard to know.
Yeah, I mean, all of these things require careful interpretation. In many cases, there are going to be arguments in favour of it being a more accurate literal description and arguments in favour of it being something more mythical. On topic, say, bestiaries, that's a complicated one because clearly some of the animals they contain, like unicorns and manticores and things, are entirely invented. And you wouldn't take those documents as evidence that such things actually existed in the Middle Ages. But they do also contain real animals. And then you think, so, well, how do the people involved come into contact with those animals? Must have been because they were actually out there in the environment. Mm. Therefore, people were encountering them. Where were they encountering them? What were the populations of them like? Were the populations of them high enough that people writing the documents could bet on the people reading them having some familiarity with these things, and so on and so on? You can get into a discussion about that. With the Defoe example, it's a really interesting one. He says a million swallows. I don't know whether to take him at his word on that. I think I mentioned in the piece that 30,000 swallows or thereabouts congregated in Anglesey a few years ago, and footage of that was caught on TV. Given that insect populations were probably substantially higher in the 18th century when Defoe was writing, I don't think it's totally impossible that the number of starlings that he found was about a million, although he wasn't obviously in a position to count them in a systematic or scientific way. And one of the things I suppose I'm encouraging people to consider in writing the article is that when they encounter reports of large numbers of wild animals in historical or literary documents, they shouldn't necessarily dismiss them as sort of imaginative embellishment. So I was recently looking at Aurora Leigh, which is a verse novel by Elizabeth Barrett Browning written in the middle of the 19th century. And there's a bit there where she refers to multitudes of nightingales. Now, nightingales are a pretty rare bird. So if I'd read that a year or two ago before doing some of the reading into this article, I would have thought to myself, multitudes of nightingales, seriously? And now I think to myself, actually, maybe she's including that because she really has, encountered nightingales in considerable numbers.
Mm.
And actually, that's backed up by some more systematic surveying. So the British Trust for Ornithology, for example, estimates that nightingale populations in about 1800 were 15 times higher than they were today.
Wow. And it at least gives you an idea of the relative commonness of something, doesn't it? Things in relation to one another too, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And of course, things like predator and prey species, you'd expect their populations to have some kind of correlation. But you wouldn't think, say, of a bit of longitudinal data about nightingales produced by the British Trust for Ornithology as actually being a useful document for interpreting a verse novel written by a mid-19th century writer. But I actually think you might be able to illuminate something by putting sources like those together.
It's another way into understanding, it seemed to me, isn't it, of the landscape of the past and also, as you say, the literature that came from it. Because talking about nightingales, I was struck by the line you say in your piece, when Keats wrote about a nightingale singing in North London, he wasn't writing about a rare or extraordinary event. Now we'd go, oh, it's a nightingale, partly because of the myth around it, but also partly because we're quite unlikely to have heard a nightingale. Mm. But whereas actually, if he's saying, oh, yes, there was a nightingale singing, and that's like us saying, well, there was a pigeon on the phone line. It requires a shift in imagination in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, this is one of the things I comment on in the article. I feel the declines in wildlife populations are not something that people who are learning history are standardly taught about. Like, people who are learning about history often encounter ideas about what has changed over long periods of time. So, human population has increased, humans have expanded around the globe, technology has increased, literacy rates have increased, human lifespans have increased. People are familiar with a lot of these long-term trends. But actually, the idea that the natural world that our ancestors encountered was radically different from the one we encounter, I don't think has yet entered that sort of standard repertoire of long-term trends that someone turning their attention toward history should probably be aware of.
The only example I can think of is if you're learning about America and the Native Americans, one of the many ways in which they slaughtered the Native Americans was by getting rid of the bison. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think Amitav Ghosh's book, The Nutmeg's Curse, deals with that and some other instances of deliberate habitat degradation as a sort of method of colonial control.
But that's one particularly brutal example. I was also struck, there's a There's a very poignant statement by Edmund Gosse that you quote when he's talking about the 1850s. Can you tell us about that? Because that rang very true, and that's from nearly 200 years ago.
Yeah, so Edmund Gosse was a man of letters who was mostly sort of famous in the later part of the 19th century and early 20th century, but he wrote a very compelling memoir called Father and Son about growing up with his father, who was a naturalist in the middle of the 19th century. And his father sort of disagreed with the Darwinian view of evolution and went to various lengths to try to confute it. But because of Gosse's father being a naturalist, Gosse was taken on all kinds of rambles around the coasts of Britain, studying rock pools, particularly in the West Country. And he writes about the coast of Devon and Cornwall being so denuded by later visitors that no one will see the shore of England again in the way that I did in my early childhood. And he describes it as a ring of beauty thronged with beautiful, sensitive forms of life. And so he was presumably there comparing what he'd encountered in his childhood with what he'd encountered in later life, and marking a huge change, which is important because if you were to read something like, you know, modern reports on the state of the natural world, a lot of them take as their baseline a date in the 1970s. And that might lead you to think that in 1970, everything is sort of in a pristine or default state. But someone like Gosse points you to the conclusion that actually in 1970, things are already considerably depleted.
This is the real hammer blow, I suppose, that comes through so much of your piece, is this has all been going on for much, much, much longer than you might wish to believe.
Yeah, I think there's a whole question here about the ontology of the climate and the environment crisis. The more I've worked on this as a topic, the more I think people have real difficulty conceiving of it. And I think one conception of it that you often encounter is of a disaster which may happen in the future, but which we can avert through canny behaviour now. Like it's a sort of asteroid approaching the Earth, but if we're really clever, we can knock it off course and it will miss us. But actually, at least as far as the ecology is concerned, things probably aren't like that. Probably there has been extinction and the diminution of wildlife populations going on for a very, very long time, hundreds, thousands of years into the past. So that would then mean that the crisis is not something that in the future that you can avert through skillful behaviour. It's something we're living in. And most of the people you've read books by were living in. And then you need to start thinking about much longer kind of timescales. And you reconceive the whole kind of crisis. It looks very, very different, I think, once you start taking that kind of viewpoint.
It's not that we want to go, oh, well, it's been going on for ages, so, you know, not much we can do about it. I suppose it's also about the relative speed and what we've got left, which compared to what there was from your survey is an absolutely minute fraction of what there was.
Yeah, it's important to emphasise that these changes are accelerating. Although, as I've said, there's lots of uncertainty in this field. I think there is quite a strong consensus that in the last few decades, a lot of these changes have been speeding up. I mean, as with global warming, you know, there have been significant human-produced greenhouse gas emissions since the Industrial Revolution onwards and, you know, earlier in some cases as well. But obviously they've increased enormously in recent history. I think the data on wildlife populations depict something similar.
You say at one point when you're talking about the kind of rethinking, I mean, it's a rethinking, I suppose you were saying it earlier, of how people learn about history, isn't it? Because there's a phrase you've got, what might in one account be progress might in another be a massive and unsustainable transfer of benefits from non-human living beings to human ones.
Yeah, I'm responding really there to the American writer Steven Pinker. He argues in his book, Better Angels of Our Nature, that really, particularly since the 18th century, life has been improving for loads of people. And he produces loads and loads of evidence indicating that violence has decreased and, you know, lifespans have gone up and healthcare has improved and democracy has spread around the world and so on and so on. And when reading that, I found myself thinking, well, OK, I can go along with this to a certain extent, but there's very little here about how this affects the natural world. And if you think that non-human living beings have some sort of value in themselves or have some rights or some interests that you need to take account of, suddenly this human progress looks very, very different. It looks more like something has been taken away from the natural sphere, if you like, and shunted across into the human one, rather than something, you know, human well-being, simply growing at the cost of nothing else.
Yeah, that's what we're doing this weekend. We're thinking and we're regaining our sense of wonder. It will take us much more than a weekend. Thank you so much, Gabriel Roberts, for joining us and talking to us.
That was so interesting. Thank you ever so much.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Still to come on the show, Gwendolyn Riley joins us to delve into the world of Michael Bracewell, the acclaimed chronicler of British culture, whose novel Unfinished Business is his first for 21 years. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Welcome back, I'm Alex Clark. It's been 21 years since the publication of Michael Bracewell's last novel, Perfect Tense, although this fastidious and sharp-eyed chronicler of British culture has hardly been idle. The last few years, for example, have given us books such as Remake, Remodel, An Exploration of Roxy Music, works on artists Gilbert and George and Richard Hamilton, and Souvenir, An Elegy to London in the 1980s. But now Bracewell has returned to fiction and to a previous character. Unfinished Business reintroduces us to Martin Knight, first encountered in The Conclave, but now very much older. The novelist, Gwendolyn Riley, has reviewed the book in this week's paper and joins us now. Welcome, Gwendolyn.
My pleasure.
He is clearly somebody whose work you are very connected to. I mean, it seems from your review that you have read him for a long time and very sort of deeply. Is that fair?
Why not? Yes, I think it is fair. I was thinking the other day that I was well into my teens before I realised there was such a thing as a contemporary English novelist. I think, you know, I was reading my classics and I thought novelists were Victorians or Russians or at a push from the 1920s. And then at some point I began to realise there were writers writing today. And at some point I came across Michael Bracewell's first novel, The Crypto Amnesia Club, which I think was published in 1988. So maybe I found it in a charity shop or something and was struck by the cover, the title, I have to say by the author photo as well. Good looking guy. And,
so that's another good reason to buy a book.
Yeah. And so stylish. And it's, I mean, the phrases and the brooding quality of that book really struck me. And I think there's bits of it I could probably still say off by heart. Yeah, so that's where I came across him first. And then, yeah, we'd sort of pick those books up.
Fiction was that first way into his work for you?
Oh, goodness, absolutely. I don't know if I haven't read the Roxy Music biography. Sorry, Michael. I haven't read the books about art because that's not my world. I mean, I like art, but I don't really read about it. And I know he does a catalogue copy and things like that and essays on artists, but I haven't looked at them at all. So for me, the last time I read him was, 2001 when Perfect Tense came out, which, yeah, I remember really loving. That's a book about, not dissimilar when you read the first few pages of Unfinished Business, this new book's not dissimilar from Perfect Tense, which was about this man who works in an office in the city in London. And sort of one day just doesn't go in and has this strange odyssey around London. And very eerie, very affecting, and really good book.
It's the style. I mean, sorry, that's such a sort of obvious thing mm-hmm. to say. But I mean, Unfinished Business, when it opens, here we are meeting Martin Knight again. He's very much older. As I said, he's 57, and we kind of know immediately that he's in kind of trouble. He's divorced. He's in poor health. I mean, his everything's kind of hurting in those first few pages. He has given up smoking, even though there's a kind of rather wonderful sort of, well, a kind of elegy to cigarettes and what they have meant to him. He has given it up, but he's still drinking a fair bit.
Oh, yes.
He's not the matinee idol that the sort of two pages of the prologue of the novel give us via a photograph, don't they? There's a kind of framing to this book.
Mm, yeah, the prologue is very interesting, and it's very touching, actually. It's sort of, it's him sitting for a portrait almost. So it's a memory of him when I think he's 17, sitting on a garden chair while his girlfriend is very much in love with him, takes a picture of him, and they describe the resulting photograph of this handsome young man. The word that I lit on in my review was almost, because the photograph, his look is described as almost fierce. And as you read the book, you realize quite how much that almost admits, because there's still that nervousness there and that sense of not quite, or that sense of taint and worry, maybe even. So as the book unfolds, it's written in the third person, but very closely from his point of view at certain points. And it's him looking back and thinking, where did it all go wrong? Or where did he veer off a right path, or a path that would have led him somewhere else, I suppose? And there is this sense of taint or even degeneracy. And he traces it back at a certain point. I mean, there's different things he lights upon, but he traces it back at a certain point to his first cigarette, which to the young Martin indicated a rebel attitude and cool and glamour, but that has left him, you know, in pain as he tries to climb up to the station and, you know, gasping for breath at certain points.
It sounds as though in some ways it's about promise and where the promise goes, or promises that are unfulfilled or kind of spoiled somehow. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. It's you get the sense that at a certain point Martin was, when he was a teenager, he was beguiled by a certain idea of life, and it's never quite let him go. I mean, we all were at that certain age beguiled by a certain idea of life, and you know, you stick with it or you don't. And it seems like with him, he's beginning to feel menaced by the fact that he stuck with it and thinking, where on earth has this led me? And I think the title is so interesting. Such a great title, and it's quite sly in a way, because it could almost imply a threat. I suppose it's whether he has unfinished business with life or whether life has unfinished business with him. And it's sort of both as the book unfolds. You realize that there are still dreadful things to come. I mean, he really suffers physically, and then there's certain events that happen with his daughter, and yeah, it's bad. But he's very brave, he's very dogged, again unfinished business, and he's quite diligent, and it's just really interesting. I had some very eerie moments, this book.
I found it exactly that. And that sort of mapping onto the city, which is kind of, I mean, it announces itself, you know, pretty sort of obviously. It's not, you know, that's not my brilliant textual analysis, because as it opens, you know, we're in Cambridge Heath Road near Bethnal Green, Dalston, Hackney, this kind of just to the east end of the centre of London. And then very quickly he starts to mention, you know, Piccadilly and South Kensington and these sort of memories of going to these kind of beautiful arcades and squares and rich people's houses. And it seems that there is this, you know, and for people, you know, not familiar with the places I first mentioned, Bethnal Green, etc. I mean, they certainly have a kind of a chicness and a sort of creativity to them and a huge kind of interest, but they're not what you call posh, are they? And he seems to have almost kind of found himself slightly sort of washed up in this bit of London.
Yeah, definitely. There's a bit where he says old streets and new buildings. And it's a fantastic London novel. And there are strange corners and tube stations and bits of it that they have indelible scenes on them, which whenever I'm in those places now, you know, bits of by Olympia in Kensington, near where we live, and Holland Park tube station, there's a very moving scene just on the platform on one of those benches. They'll stick with me now. There's a Malcolm Lowry poem that begins, "Trapped in a Liverpool of self, I haunt the guttered arcades of the past." In a way, Martin Knight is haunting the guttered arcades of the past, but in London. I also thought it was a brilliant novel of sort of London weather. I was thinking my previous favourite on that score was The Years by Virginia Woolf. She can capture, you know, is exactly what an early October afternoon in Hyde Park is like. Somehow she gets it. And it's very similar with this. You think, yep, if we're talking about a February evening in the beginning of February, that, I mean, there's a lot of white skies and wintry skies in this book, a lot, because a lot of the vantage points where Martin Knight is looking out at the city, they're a little bit elevated, like Cambridge Heath Station or you know, various buildings he's in, looking out from the window of his own flat. There's a sense that he's sort of psychically stranded and sort of physically a little bit elevated and above things and sort of looking out too. So, yeah.
It sounds a bit like, I mean, not quite, but almost kind of Ian Sinclair psychogeography.
That dread word.
I'm sorry I said it. I'm sorry.
No. It's in my notes, Lucy. You've taken the fall for me there. I'd written it down myself. And it is a dread word, but Ian Sinclair, he does come to mind, doesn't he?
Well, because it just sounds so specific and so kind of, I don't know what the word is. You're describing it much better than I can, but the sort of haunting of particular places and the giving of meaning and that's with the conjuring it up with the weather and everything.
Yeah, I think in another world, maybe Martin Knight would have had a psychogeography blog, but no, not in the world of this book. I thought it was really interesting, actually, how technology features or doesn't feature in this book, because he's very into his music, Martin, and there are certain songs that come back to him and little bits of lyrics. But the thing you don't have is him going around with his headphones in at all. And I thought that really fitted with the idea of him sort of remembering his past and on this strange quest to find out where things went wrong. He's not into distraction. If he were really a nostalgist, he could be listening to The Damned or whoever it might be while he's walking around. And I don't feel like he is quite. He's after a different kind of meaning. And I thought that was quite, it's almost like the fact that he's isolated is because he isn't distracting himself. He isn't in that kind of technological, you know, rabbit hole that one could get into.
Well, he sort of rules himself out of lots of things to do with modern life, I think, doesn't he, in a way? I'd also say he is clearly the sort of central character, this kind of close third person narration. But, I mean, there are other characters, not least his ex-wife, Marilyn, who I found very moving also because she's kind of trying to sort of keep her life on the rails, isn't she? She's trying to keep sort of forging ahead in a way that he isn't exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's largely about him, but I mean, A, he's not solipsistic, so we get a lot of his observation of people. And I read a review, not mine, which described it as like a street photographer, the way he captures people he sees around London. I think I've thought of it more as a crowded sketchbook page. There's just lots of little pen portraits of people he sees. And then there are these other characters that we hear their stories sort of in parallel to his, and one of them is his ex-wife Marilyn, who is the daughter of, I think, maybe a sort of royal court free cinema type person, a sort of Primrose Hill Marxist, very rich, very boho. And there's a brilliant phrase where they're described as determined to talk. They're quite pompous and so there are those stories as well. And yeah, so while Martin is suffering, Marilyn is embarking on an affair with, you know, I mean, there's the rich in this book and then there's the super rich, and she's having an affair or beginning a love affair with someone who is super rich. So we get all that side of London as well, which is something I know nothing about, alas, but, you know, these very beautiful restaurants they're sort of stepping into silently because the carpets are so thick, and the marvellous engagement party that they have. So again, there's so much in here. It's such a short book as well. It's not 200 pages, but it crams in a hell of a lot.
There's a phrase that you used, I mean, it's, I think you're describing that kind of framing narrator, but that sort of attitude of the novel is almost a talk with slides at a historical society, which really was, again, such a specific way of describing it. It immediately chimed with me. It was very, there is a little bit of let us show you what life is like, as well as this sort of very affecting kind of personal sort of interior story.
God, absolutely, yeah. It's not solipsistic, even though this is this brooding man who, you know, when we see him speak to other characters in the book, his sentences are, you know, extremely stark and there's not much to them. Maybe, I mean, that image came to me of the talk, and maybe that was because I was Googling Michael Bracewell, and there's lots of YouTube videos of him doing that with, you know, artists that he's talking about. So you do see him pressing the button on the slide projector and going, and here is Brian Ferry in 1984, whatever it might be. So maybe I had that image in my mind, but it did seem, especially for the prologue, I thought, yeah, that's it. Let's examine these people.
Is he a sort of specialist of it's the 80s and 90s, is it? That's what he's written his criticism about. Is that right? I mean, not only that, but kind of.
Not only that. Yeah, there was a book called The 90s When Surface Was Depth, which I haven't read. And then there was this, and then there was Souvenir, this really interesting book that came out a couple of years ago. I'm wondering if he was writing this contemporaneously, is that the word, with or concurrently with Unfinished Business. I wonder how hard it was to disaggregate at points, because they do, the sort of golden period in Martin's life definitely coincides with what this strange elegy for that period, Souvenir, was looking at. So the London of the late 70s and early 80s, especially that prologue, that could be Martin sitting for one of the little portraits that make up Souvenir, which sort of goes from character to character in this remembered London. But I suppose quite different ways of looking at the past or what the past is for. The Souvenir felt more like an act of restoration or retrieval, and this one is, there's a bit more of a urgency to his looking at the past, or it's a bit more emotional, I suppose, personal. I wonder how it was to write them both together.
I mean, I don't know anything about him sort of biographically, I mean personally speaking, and I'm not suggesting in any way that this is or isn't a sort of autobiographical novel. I don't know how closely it mirrors, but there does seem to be a kind of interest in these particular figures whose lives have been kind of shaped by their interest in aesthetics and observation, and the sort of question of whether actually that leads you down a path that sort of alienates you, I suppose, a word actually you use in the and remark upon using in the review, but how it sort of takes you away from really being properly sort of engaged with your own life. And our aesthetics are kind of dead end sometimes, I suppose.
Absolutely.
It's a surface and depth sort of question, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it comes up again and again, and it's very foxing and very, there was a line in the book that struck me, and I didn't even know what to think of it, and it kind of gave me the shivers and intrigued me at the same time, where Martin says, perhaps the pursuit of the interesting makes you invisible. And I thought, ooh,
whoa,
what do I think of that?
Because what does that mean?
I know.
Should we be pursuing the boring? I mean, maybe.
Well, I know, and because my whole thing is I absolutely adore people who pursue the interesting and who are interested in things other than themselves. But in this case, you feel like there's been some kind of weird card trick or some sleight of hand that has left Martin, not quite knowing where he is or who he is. Or, I mean, the end of the book is so interesting, and the last lines are very moving, and you feel like it's not quite clear whether the whole thing has been worth it because he's found the thing that I won't mention, or if it's been a terrible wasting exercise. Anyway, makes you think.
It makes you think. We should also say, I'm going to say, that it's also very funny. I mean, it's very funny on a sort of observational and sentence level sometimes, and there's a bit of characters described as archaically busty.
Yes.
I thought it was such a brilliant, and Marilyn is wearing a coat and she's wondered if she's dressed up to go on a date, and she's wondering if she's gone too far with it, and she thinks she just looks berserk. And it's a brilliant description of this coat, which is sort of made in gay bachelor soft tweed, that I thought just completely sort of opened up, and like you kind of knew what that meant entirely. And he sees people getting off a train, does he, and thinks everyone looks like they live in Berlin, and you think, oh god, that just captures exactly a certain sort of person in London. You make a parallel at some point between that character and a character from Anthony Powell, which was again in your review. I thought, god, that's interesting. I wouldn't have put exactly these two writers together, but I sort of see it once you said it.
Yeah, I mean, I love Paul, and I think that was partly the alcoholism, because you learn at a certain point that Martin isn't just drinking a lot, he's drinking a lot, and he's drinking every day, and he's, this is part of his disconnection in a way. This search for the elevated has led him to, need his mood elevated in this way. And there's the drunk in Anthony Paul is poor Stringham, who at a certain point stops drinking and says, I just need to get things clear in my mind. Something similar, that's his whole project now. And there was something about the doggedness and diligence of Martin Knight's, trying to go through his past. It just felt the same sort of, slight drunk or ex-drunk concentration. I thought it instantly came to me. But again, I think with these, I mean, I suppose I'm also thinking now of the sort of Mark Boxer cartoons that are on the front of the Pole novels, or a certain edition of them. There's something of that in the descriptions. I'm thinking now there's a bit where he remembers being at university, Martin, he was at university in Liverpool, and he does this sort of scan around the coffee bar. I guess this would be late 70s, I think. It's just a lot of brown wool and pasty skin and zits, and it's quite a good sort of sketchbook page of Liverpool 80s students, I guess. Very funny.
There is a point where you say, again, in the review, you say that the risk here is that the reader is just not going to care what's happening to this man, and that it will, as you make the point, he's not solipsistic, but the story may appear to be so. But I think the fact that it is so funny in these little sort of acid drops of humour kind of gets it out of that. That's sort of how I responded to it anyway.
Oh, God, yeah, that was me being probably needlessly defensive for someone saying, oh, who wants to read about
oh, no, it's bloke? Always good to get the defense in before someone says it, I find.
It's so funny. I also look, there's sort of these weird sort of Billy Liar-esque fantasies that Martin sort of goes on. There's bits where he's suddenly looking at the work meeting he's in and seeing them all in a post-apocalyptic city. And a bit where he's...
I felt like that in meetings sometimes, I have to say.
Well, yeah. No, I can imagine.
It's not unreasonable. There's a thing you reminded me of, Alex mentioning, saying that everyone that got off the train looked as though they were in Berlin. Because you say also that because he's... You said he spends his time standing sort of maybe slightly higher, slightly elevated, or looking out of windows, and he's got his dark, his long overcoat on. And it reminded you of the angel standing around in Wings of Desire, which is such a strong image, and also such an, again, such a loved 80s. It is 80s, isn't it, Wings of Desire?
I think so, yeah. So either that or, you know, a Simple Minds video. The overcoat looms large, that's for sure. Yeah, and he's standing at these elevated positions alone, looking out, and, you know, unable to communicate as well, or unable to quite, you know...
Join in,
yeah. So that did seem very like that film.
That was really interesting. You make that connection, I mean, just sort of conversationally, I suppose. But the music video, which, of course, you know, mm-hmm. here was its sort of moment of supremacy in the 80s and 90s, and evidently Absolutely. He's so incredibly interested in mm-hmm. surface depth, pop culture. But there seemed to me this sort of idea somehow that the high culture has almost been hijacked, I suppose, by things like the music video. So you might stand looking like a matinee idol and you might want to be thought of as a very deep thinking intellectual, but actually you look like you're in a Simple Minds video.
Oh, God.
What a thought for us all. I tell you, I read this book, I mean, this, it's all very well for you two, but for those of us reading who are not very much younger than Martin Nice, it was even more frightening a novel to read, I'll tell you that. I mean, we all hurt going upstairs these days. Decay all around us, we see it. Gwendolyn, if I can, mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit, just a little bit, because we're talking about Michael Bracewell, and that is the pretense under which I've got you onto this podcast. But there is this phrase that you use about his characters, mm-hmm. Bracewell's characters, that they have some maddening idea of a higher life. And that immediately made me think of the connection to your own novels. That is sometimes what your protagonists, I'm thinking about the narrator of My Phantoms, your most recent novel, a novel that you know because I've embarrassingly told you I think is a masterpiece.
Keep talking.
I just the most...
Tell me again.
I read it with my jaw kind of hitting the floor at how just that great it was. That's it. I'm not... Listeners, that's it. I'm stopping. That's the last thing I'll
take. What's
the question, Alex?
Terrible gush I'll do. Ask the question, Alex. But that is sometimes how your protagonists feel, isn't it? That's sort of, you know, there is this idea of somewhere they want to get to that they don't quite know how or even what it is when they get there.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. The mother character in My Phantoms was constantly just rattling the handle on life, thinking, I need to get into life, something. Not quite clear what, or if she's got an idea, just that it's not where she currently is. Yeah, and I suppose that sort of broody romance was there from my first book, and I wonder if a lot of that wasn't from Crypto Amnesia Club, you know, walking at night in the club and everything. But certainly, yeah, the idea of wanting that higher life or that different life, I don't know, it's the Leonard Best in all of us as well, maybe. Yeah. Us, not them. Yeah.
Just before we get crushed.
Oh dear. I'm going to ring the bell again for how funny a book this is and how I found it incredibly sort of invigorating. And yes, as you point out, short mm-hmm. and something that one can read in an afternoon almost. But I found it, despite the fact that it is about encroaching age and the fear of sort of waste and the inability to sort of go back and put things right, I did find it a strangely comforting novel as well as a frightening one. And you do end your review by saying you wondered whether it actually was quite a hopeful book in some ways.
I did, and I'm just because of the ending and because this emphasis on a friendship, which I don't know if at the end the friendship is going to turn into anything more, or if it's just there's a moment where Martin's very ill and then a friend comes to see him and he suddenly sees them anew. And to me, it was the most moving moment in the book where he's sort of there, you know, in his bed, hospital bed, blinking at this woman. And he suddenly sees her differently. And it was so Oh, it was so striking. It reminded me of the bit in The Winter's Tale where the statue is suddenly comes to life. Oh, she's warm. Suddenly he was looking at his friend and saw her differently. And you thought, wow, there it is. There's the thing that was needed from the beginning, which is someone who understands and fellowship and, you know, warmth and friendship, maybe romance, I don't know, but certainly real fellowship and friendship and care. And that Martin saw that and had that. And, you know, they have quite a droll rapport through the book anyway, these two characters. And that at the end, I thought, that's what the unfinished business is. It's between these two, maybe. Or maybe that's me being an old soppy. I don't know.
Well, you sort of have to wait for the next novel, don't you? And then you don't know if it's going to be 21 years.
Well, so quite.
It's tricky. I mean, I'm hoping not as well, because I love this book. It's, we might wonder whether novels like this now too easily sort of get written off as kind of introspective and not much happens. Mm-hmm. And are they very much about the world? But I'm very much hoping not, as I think from your review you are too.
Gosh, yes. Yep.
It's terrific. So this is a hard recommend from us.
Rock
That's
hard.
Not a phrase I've ever heard before, but yes. It's not a hard pass. It's the other thing.
It's not a hard pass. That's exactly what I was going to say. That's what people say in the culture these days. It's not a hard pass. It's not a hard no. It's a hard yes. So, Gwendolyn, thank you so much for coming and enthusing with us about Michael Bracewell. And so, Unfinished Business, we hard recommend. I will hard recommend My Phantoms and Gwendolyn's other novels too. Thank you ever so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Gabriel Roberts and Gwendolyn Riley.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.